The views and opinions expressed by the guests, callers, and hosts on this and all Rents Radio Network programs do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the network, its commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. In these controversial times, we believe the First Amendment and freedom of the press are absolutely essential to the survival of our nation. Thank you. And now, enjoy the program.
Is going to be a memorable program, and as they all are when we have William Tompkins on. Bill has been really single-handedly responsible for providing some of the most provocative information in the so-called disclosure paradigm that we've ever heard. And I would suspect, through the good graces of Frank Chile, and George Feiler is along tonight as well, Frank has been instrumental in helping coordinate all of these, and I think what honestly is going on here, I think we have every reason to believe that what's going on here is intentional disclosure at a level never seen before. This goes way back. As you know, Bill Tompkins just celebrated his 93rd birthday. His mind is every bit as sharp as it has ever been. It's extraordinary. I knew one other gentleman who was in his 90s who had a mind like that, and it just floored me. And I'm always in awe of Bill's incredible recall. George Feiler, are you standing by there, sir?
Standing by, as always.
Yeah, these have been quite some programs. What are your thoughts on these programs so far?
Well, I met Bill a couple of years ago after I spoke, and I was introduced to him by Dr. Bob Woods, and he said, listen to this gentleman, that he has a lot to say, and he certainly does, and we've been trying to get this information out for a couple of years of what he has learned through his experiences in the past working for the various aviation companies. And I've often found that if a person is in the right place at the right time, they'll have wonderful information to provide to our listeners. And this is what I plan on hearing tonight, some of his excellent information.
Yeah, it has been really unforgettable. And I do think it's not belaboring the point to mention that this is a level of disclosure that we've really not been exposed to before.
Well, I've heard bits and pieces that are similar. And
understand. Yes, so have I. But this is, it's kind of all in one thread here, and it's remarkable to listen to.
It is. And it's it's wonderful that he's willing to talk about it. And that's another thing that's going on is that others are confirming what he is saying.
Right.
That even though it seems so extraordinary, there's others coming forward to explain similar stories.
Well, we're carrying on. Dr. Michael Sala will be here a week from tonight. Herbert Dorsey will be back again. And next Monday, I have a surprise guest, a true surprise guest, who is involved with many of the things that Clark McClelland was. He knows Clark. I'm still trying to get in touch with Clark. I'm very concerned.
Yes.
But this man worked with Apollo 6 and 7 and other elements of the NASA program down there and has much to say. His first visit will be this coming Monday night. Now, I would hope that all of you listening recognize the value of these programs. They're up for free listens on my homepage on the right column, and they will stay there. And share them and understand that These are extraordinary in every sense of the word. Frank Chile, are you there?
I'm here, Jeff. Good evening.
I'm always thanking you. I want to thank you again for doing so much by way of producing and coordinating in the background. You've made all this possible, and I really appreciate it on behalf of everyone listening who really cares about this kind of material. Oh, we lost you. Try again, Frank.
Well, what I find to be remarkable, it's an honor to do all this, but I, since I began talking to Bill on a regular basis, information has been flowing to me that I've been sharing with you and Bill and George and Dr. Wood. It seems to substantiate his story and encourages even more to come out.
Yeah, yeah. There is nothing to be said about this except the images that we're going to look at and talk about tonight are stunning. They're just amazing. They should be listed up now in guests at Rents. If you go and let's all go take a look. I pull up a new reload on the page and make sure they're there. It should say photos under Bill Tompkins' name and videos and photos of German discs. You'll find it right in the guests section. Bill will be with us for 3 hours tonight. When you go to the photos, you might as well load that page up now. There is a video that I have put together with my editor. Steve just did a magnificent job. And it is possibly the only piece of film of a flying German advanced anti-gravity craft that we have on our side of the fence. I would suggest the government probably has crates of film. The Germans always documented everything, and these craft, when they flew, were no doubt filmed. We don't have any of the footage. This 8-second clip of a flying German disc was available. I grabbed it. I saw the potential. I asked Steve to do certain things to make sure it was fully presented. He did marvelous work on this presentation. You can see a German disc. We believe this to be credible and real. It's not a Photoshop. It's not a fraud. We think it's the real deal. And when you see it, I think you'll understand. It's quite old. It's black and white. And the way Steve handled it by enlarging and zooming in, which I asked him to do, and he did it. I didn't think he could. We'll show you much more than the eye would see in just an 8-second run-by. And certainly on that video and photos page, you're going to see all the pictures that we're going to walk through tonight with Bill Tompkins. And they are virtually all the pictures that we know that we have of German flying discs. I don't want to call them UFOs because they were identified. They were German. We could call them flying saucers if that makes you feel better. That's fine. But they clearly had technology that was astounding. And we're going to talk more about that tonight. Anything else to add, Frank?
No, Bill's got a hell of a story to share with us tonight and stuff that's going to be heard for the very first time.
Yeah, all right.
How do we find that on their website there?
Go to guests on the left-hand side, where it says Friday, William Tompkins with George Filer, that's you, George, and Frank Chile, right underneath your name and Frank's name, says videos and photos of German discs. You see that?
Right. I found it.
Just click on that, everybody, and load it up. And don't look at the video yet. You'll have plenty of time to look at it later. But it is, the music is, it is a stunning video. I'm going to release it all over the internet. It's about 8.5 minutes long, and it is really something. So we'll go through that. It has many of the pictures you're going to see in still form as you scroll down below, but it has other things as well. So don't miss. Okay, let's welcome back the man of the hour once again, Bill Tompkins. Hello, Bill. Thanks for being here.
Hello, Jay, and all those beautiful people out there.
There's some great people. I guess you've been getting some feedback from some of them?
Yes, we have. In fact, the phone is off the hook, and the mail is coming in, and actually there was one very interesting card, which was really a birthday card. And I think you fellas know what that's all about.
Yeah, yeah. I think we read it last time out, didn't we, Frank?
Yes.
Very good. Okay. Now, Bill Tompkins was, among other things, a child prodigy. He was given a quick evaluation on a trial by the U.S. Navy and just pulled right up to the top level. His model building of the Navy's most advanced ships during World War II and stuff caught everyone's attention in the late 30s. He was put into the Navy's highest level of debriefing spies that were somehow being inserted into the highest levels of German technology during the war. Those spies who were involved with aeronautics and so forth were rotated out of Germany and brought back to North Island, San Diego, and debriefed by three people, Bill Tompkins being one of them, because Bill understood the idea of structure, flight, and all of that. He was an amazing asset to the Navy. There was an admiral involved, and I'm not sure who the third person was, but these people would come back and they would be debriefed. Then they would be sent back to Germany, I guess, if they felt they could successfully reinsert them into the Third Reich. It was quite a story. All right, Bill, let's pick it up wherever you'd like. We've got pictures to go through. Are you able to see the pictures right now? Did you load them?
I don't have them loaded, but I got them laid out right here.
Okay. So, I'll try and describe them I'll try and describe them for you as we go through, and since you're not looking at them on computer, we'll be able to give a good description from your perspective as well. All right, so let's pick up the story. And when you, by the way, when you see the video, you're going to love it. You will love it. It's right there at the top of our pictures. We'll make sure you get a link to it if you haven't already. Okay, go ahead, Bill.
Well, I think that trying to look at these pictures, actually, Frank is the one that's been providing me with these more recent photographs of the German aircraft, spacecraft, and somehow acquired these, and I think it's part of, as you've just presented, some sort of collective disclosure on the part of different individuals, and trying to get the information out to the public. So,
you know, Bill, one thing, if I might interrupt, is what better way to go about disclosing than to show the history, how this stuff has been around for a long time. It didn't just happen. And to build a case, really think about it, in the hands of the so-called enemy of World War II. It's a safe way to kind of back into it. Maybe that's what's going on, at any rate.
Well, if for possibly the viewers that haven't been listening to what we were saying, it might be advisable to just say how we started.
Sure.
Just quick overview. The Navy had a admiral who was commander of Naval Air Station San Diego, the largest naval facility in aircraft in the country, and that was a big, almost an aircraft company. What they did is they brought the airplanes back from the aircraft carriers and even the big flying boats. PBYs. They brought them back to the base, and they tore them down, rebuilt them, put new engines in them, put new weapons on them, and completely rebuilt the airplanes, and then put them back out into the service. And so this North Island Naval Air Station, the primary area, of course, we had seven squadrons training there, also active, but the second most important was this great big, like an aircraft company, and the head of that particular engineering group was, he's called the president of engineering, but he's a Navy captain, and then you have group engineers, and these are Navy commanders, and so it's very interesting the way the structure was set up. Most people don't even know how it operated, anyway, Admiral Riccoboni had this other hobby. And I want to say from the start that we're not talking about naval intelligence here. Admiral Riccoboni was not involved in naval intelligence. He was only involved in acquiring information from Germany using naval spies operative to bring the information back of what had been presented to Germany by the Draco and reptilian extraterrestrials. So those people then made a plan for the SS and the Third Reich to actually, I think we really need to step back a little further.
Sure.
And sort of ask ourselves, okay, how did this get started? And forget about the Navy being involved.
And it did get started in the 1930s, I guess, or maybe before.
Even before. Jeff, you're absolutely right. And a program, a group of people, one young lady, a beautiful 13-year-old girl, was telepathically given some information. Now, I know people don't believe this, and I know you're saying Bill smoking pot again, but what I'm trying to explain is what really did happen. And this young lady was contacted telepathically and told to design and build both a very advanced propulsion system and build very large transports, space transports, bring all of her family, all of her friends, and as many as 2,000 or 3,000 people on board, leave the planet, go out into the galaxy to another star's planet, and move there where the geology of that planet is not as bad as it is here on Earth.
Thanks to humankind wrecking it. So she was given basically a ticket to ride and take all the people she wanted and others out of here at the end of her mission. Now, telepathy, I think, is accepted by most everyone listening here as quite real, so it doesn't come as a great shock that she would receive information. Go ahead. This is very interesting.
Okay, so in the book that I put out, Selected by Extraterrestrials, in that book, there's a whole chapter, and then there's references about five or six places in the book about a 1,442 thing. Well, what's that? Well, it turns out that separate from this young lady, it was established by our Navy operatives that this group of people, it turned out to be 12, 14 young ladies helping this first girl, and then it expanded out to a large number of people in Germany who had nothing to do with military, nothing to do with the SS, and independently, this group had farmers in it, it had shoe salesmen, it had scientists, it had technicians, and all these people collectively worked on information that was given to them to design and build, first of all, saucers to get you to learn how to do it, and then build the large transports to leave the planet.
Now, these saucers were not just given to the Germans. They were given to the Germans through the telepathy given to this young girl. That's the way it came about.
Yes, and that part is very interesting, too, because when the SS, the Third Reich, found out about what they were doing, they took it over. And for a short period of time, they just took everything. And then somebody made a decision, okay, that's another source. Let them go do it. Yet they let the 1,400 people go do that. And so it separated. These were
so the SS grabbed it.
Different.
The SS grabbed it and then let it go. And kept, they had a parallel program, I assume.
Right. Now, the reason they let it go is the Dracos and the Reptilians made an agreement with Hitler and the SS to essentially take out people that he didn't like. All right? And then the second thing was to take, and I don't like to say this, people, but this is what it was, to enslave every other person on the planet and put them into the factories to produce, in production, all of these other types of extraterrestrials, now, vehicles. Now, different than United States, where we received information, and then one of my jobs was to disseminate it and take it around to large learning institutions and aerospace and biomedical companies. But the point is that the SS were given brand new, bright, shiny UFOs. All the need was to teach them how to fly them. So Germany did not have to take information, written information and photographs, and then take that documentation and develop it. All the different parts of the vehicle, the communications, the propulsion, everything had to be started from scratch and just from information. Whereas Hitler and his people got brand new UFOs, cigars, rectangles, triangles. All these vehicles were given to them.
Hmm.
So their time frame to accomplish their mission was a tenth of the time it was taking us to try to figure out what the Navy operated presented to us.
Huh.
I think people don't understand the timeline here, what really took place. Now, the other part of the of Hitler's plan was to design, I'm sorry, was to put in production all of these different types of extraterrestrial vehicles and transports that the extraterrestrial had, put them in production all over Germany and even some of the occupied countries in underground and in mountain production buildings. These were then operated by slaves. And so that was to get the German Navy the capability of, in Navy terms, battle group size numbers of spacecraft and join the reptilian Draco Navy's battle group, spacecraft carrier battle groups, join them against other stars, planet, in this region of the galaxy, and move on out to 12 of the closest stars and do the same thing that they'd done here. Make people slaves to accomplish their agendas.
Did this require a lot of German personnel? Did it ever get to that point where they were taking thousands of crewmen and crew members on these craft?
Not thousands, but they had some of them only had crew, like 30 or 40 crew members.
Mm-hmm.
But the big transports were being built. And actually, in one of the other pages of that book of mine, there's a description of a 17-kilometer-long space transport, which I did the design on at Douglas many years later in the secret think tank. And so that was another type of thing that was being designed in Germany to take massive numbers of German military out and attack other stars, planets.
Were the Dracos and so forth short on bodies? Is this what they were doing? Were they looking for a standing army to be transported?
Yes. Now, when they're being short on bodies, Jeff, that's a good expression, because they developed a facilities where young girls, I think from 18 or 16 to 18 and 24 or something like that, years old, and they put them into these beautiful facilities, let them live there, and then let the German soldiers on leave come in and get the girls pregnant. Now, this was a massive program, which is not discussed very much, but even to the extent they went into the German-occupied areas of Russia,
mm-hmm.
and in one particular capture, they had 40,000 young girls, blue-eyed blonde girls, that were brought back to Germany and put into these facilities. The purpose was to get massive numbers of the Aryan people
right.
for all of the occupied planets that they were going to go out into the galaxy on.
Now, does this tie into the Nordics and the tall blondes that we hear so much about in this field of ufology and ET studies? This part of the Western Russian populace had Aryan characteristics, and they were sought out, that's what you're saying, and they were captured and taken back to Germany for breeding purposes.
Yes. But what we're also sort of missing was the numbers of Germans themselves, German girls, women, that were involved in this.
Uh-huh.
And the purpose was to get massive numbers of these people, transport them out to the galaxy that had the planets that they were taking over, the
uh-huh.
mission,
uh-huh.
and then operate those planets.
They were going to seed the planets with Aryan genetics, is what you're saying. I got it.
Essentially, right. So that was a completely different part of what was taking place.
Yeah.
Now, where the operatives got involved in every single type of advancement that the Germans were getting from the extraterrestrials. And so they then had the capability very early to build a 150-foot diameter UFO and put 37 or so personnel in it and fly it to Mars, which is what they did. Now, I want to step away from what we've just said and say that later on, most of this massive development program and production program was taken to Antarctica in very large caverns. The Dracos have three enormous underground caverns. Actually, we have caverns all over our planet.
Yeah, now in the Antarctic caverns, if I'm not mistaken, are certainly, we don't want to think of them as just rocks and walls and open space. They were developed, correct? They were like cities.
Oh, yes. They were unbelievably developed.
Right.
They had all of the light, just like they controlled the light like day and night. And
mm-hmm.
But these are massive facilities. You could have 30 cities in some of these massive caverns that we have on our planet. So the Germans then gave the Third Reich two other smaller ones. And when you say smaller ones, it's hard to call them small because the big ones are the size, half the size of the state of California. And but these were tremendous facilities inside, underneath the ice. And they used submarines to enter from the sea into lakes and rivers that join these various caverns together. So you
right.
didn't have to fly in there.
When you look at the video tonight, folks, you'll see a section toward the end of pictures the Germans took in the 1938-39 Antarctic expedition of some of these the enormous caverns that they found. Now, these aren't nearly as big as what Bill is describing, but you'll get the picture. Under the ice, yes, but not ice only. These are within the rock. Antarctica is a continent. Remember, it's dirt, rock, geology, covered with ice. So this is down into the continent of the Antarctic. All right, go ahead, Bill.
Well, I just wanted to get the feel of what the operatives' missions were and then what they found out. So then this group of people that I had working for me there, a large number of young ladies and some of the men, we put together what they called packages. And these were really proposals. So we had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of proposals.
This is at North Island, Bill? This is at North Island?
At North Island. And I think it's kind of interesting for anybody that has been to San Diego and looked at the aircraft carriers tied up over on North Island. If there's no carrier, you'll see the whole tower. But if there's a carrier, look onto the flight deck, and you're going to see sort of a pointed top of a building. And this is Admiral Riccobata's office, this private office he had almost at the top of that tower. And so at night, the Admiral's aide, I would be sleeping in the bunks, and he would tap me on the shoulder, and all he would say is, "They're here." And so nothing else had to be said. I got dressed real fast, and he escorted me back to the regular building and on up into that tower, into a small office area. Now, when you come into it, the Admiral's aide is not even allowed. So he escorts me to the door that goes into this office. Admiral Riccobata is sitting on my left. I'm sitting on his right. And one of three captains that I also was supposed to work for would be there. On the end of the table, there was one young lady typing. Across the table would be the Navy, usually lieutenant, operative, with a pile full of documents and sometimes equipment and sometimes photographs. So, like Jeff said a few minutes ago, what we're going to look at tonight is actually some of the photographs that the Navy operatives returned with from Germany.
Now, these are spies, operatives, okay? They're rotated in and out. Some probably pulled out never to return because it was too dangerous, and their absence, I would suggest, would alert the SS. Where do they go? Where is he?
But this has nothing to do with the U.S. Navy or naval intelligence.
I understand.
This is totally independent. And so what I think is important to the audience here is that we, even though you don't believe what we're saying, okay, try to accept that it's possible that what we're going to show you tonight and what I've been talking about is factual. And I know it's hard to justify, but I do have a great deal of documentation, which maybe I shouldn't have kept, but I do. So why don't we get into talking about some of the photographs?
Okay, very good. Now, we have a string of photographs on a page on the site, as I mentioned. Your desktop group won't necessarily match with that, so what I'll do is try and describe what I'm seeing. I'm sure that you'll be able to figure most of them out. So
yes,
if you'd like, let's, the first picture on our page that we have is a craft sitting on the ground in the snow. It's got a cockpit. It's a, looks like a pancake. It has an iron cross left and an iron cross right. It has a vertical stabilizer and a horizontal, it looks like a horizontal tail as well. Yeah, exactly. It looks like something that was an early prototype of a disc type craft, but it was designed to fly aerodynamically like an airplane. That's sitting on the ground in the snow. So what do you know about that one?
only that it was probably something that had been developed early, certainly not anything like the ones that they right. were given or the ones that they were putting in production.
Right. Now, the second picture is very much looks like a white upside-down dinner plate with some controls on it. Four controls left, two left, two right, and a center object that is protruding. I don't know what it is. Don't know what this is. It looks like the bottom of a craft of some kind. It's white, and it looks like an upside-down dinner plate.
I believe the one you're talking about, if you look at the center of that photograph,
yes,
you're looking at a cockpit, like on an airplane, and it's sort of streamlined shape. And on the lower right-hand side of that shape mm-hmm. is a window. There's one like that on the other side. And then you have this streamlined area behind this. So that's like a cockpit of you that you would put on an airplane. And there's another view of that particular picture further on, and it shows a dirigible, German dirigible. And now you're looking at the top of it, and there you can see that same two windows in the front.
Oh, yeah. Now, okay, that picture... I've taken out of our lineup because I don't think it's credible, because there are pictures of a craft very similar to that that were allegedly at an American Air Force base in the 1960s. I think that that craft was perhaps added to that dirigible to make an interesting picture, but it does have a front window and side windows. Yeah.
Yeah. I totally agree with you. Yeah, Jeff, you're right. That's got nothing to do with what we're really talking about. The dirigible is real.
And, yes.
We have many photographs of that class, yeah. German dirigibles.
Okay, so the white dinner plate in the center has a we'll call it a bulge now, and forward of that appears to be a plexiglass viewport for a pilot to sit.
Yes.
And there are some... four items poking up from the surface of it, two behind the cockpit, two in front, which have, they're black, and they look like there's small points sticking up out of the craft for some reason. All right, let's leave that one and move on to our picture number three, which is very interesting. It's a shot, black and white, of the back of an automobile, a 1930s grade automobile, with an actual trunk on the back of the car, a trunk, outside trunk, below the back window, in front of the car, which is parked, maybe a couple hundred feet in front of it, is a hovering Hanabu disc. It's black and white photo. The disc is fully visible. There's a hill behind it. Do you remember this picture?
Yes, I do.
Black and white car photograph with a disc. They're looking at it. Whoever's in the car is watching this disc hovering. All right, tell us more about that.
I have to say that I don't recognize the photo. I understood from talking to Frank it was one of these photos that was that I was given a copy of. Mm-hmm. But I'm not familiar with that vehicle at all.
Okay. Well, whoever is in it, it's apparently parked there. And who took the photograph was standing behind it. I don't know who took it, of course. And in front of the car, 150 feet, 200 feet, perhaps, is a hovering disc. Could even be further than that. It may be huge because some of these discs were enormous. So there's our third picture. We'll go to picture number four on our layout, which, again, is below our guests' names, Frank Chile and George Filer. On the left-hand side of Rents.com, load the photos, says video and photos, load them up. The next picture shows four German officers standing and talking. And in between the two on the left and the two on the right, off in the distance, is another German disc which appears to be hovering or maybe sitting on the ground. I can't tell. There's a promontory sticking out the bottom of it. It looks like a single round object into the ground. But at any rate, there is a disc behind them. And off to the right corner, way off in the distance, looks like a BF-109, perhaps parked, tail dragger. And on the left is a warehouse of some kind. It looks like an aviation hangar. All right. So you got four men with a disc behind them, and you can see the disc between two men on the left and two men on the right.
That looks very much like a real photograph, and that essentially would have been the German officers there, and the vehicle then would be one of their production versions of the UFOs.
The two men centermost in the picture, between which we see the craft in the background, have different kinds of hats on. They don't have the officers' high-brimmed hats that the SS would wear and other German military. They have more like a folded Navy cap, kind of from front to back, sits on your head rather tightly. Would they possibly have been involved in flying that craft?
They could be. They could be service people. They also could be contractors.
Oh, there you go.
Because they were probably designers talking to the naval or the German officers about the program.
Mm-hmm. Pretty amazing picture, in any case. And these do look real. We've had them examined, and most all of them check out as well as we can check them out. All right, the next picture is of a landed disc, a German disc, a car underneath it, the front of a car on the other side of the landed disc, and somebody standing on the right-hand side reaching up with his left hand and grabbing the leading edge, the circular leading edge, of this craft. It's a black figure, left hand up, grabbing the actual outer edge of this round disc. You see that one? He's actually reaching up and grabbing it. You can't miss that one.
I guess I'm missing a photograph because did not see that one. Maybe we could go to the next one.
Yeah, sure. All right, the next one is a bright daylight picture with a much different type of craft in the background, and a group of five officers talking, or four officers and one enlisted man with that different kind of cap on. Behind them is an enormous craft with two guns on the top. We'll call them guns. A series of six visible portholes on this side, an iron cross as well. And underneath the craft appears on the right-hand side that we can see to be a module with more cannons sticking out of it, perhaps. And underneath the craft is a vehicle on the opposite side. It appears to be being serviced. I would say that craft is probably 150 feet in diameter, very close to
it. It's a large one. You're right. And that's not a falsified photograph. That one is very close to what really took place. And you'll notice, too, that the 40 millimeters that were out on the upper left side, those are also, there's four of those of that craft. You can see one of them sort of pointing down like about 30 degrees.
Underneath the craft on the bottom?
Underneath the craft.
So I do, yes. Yes,
there's
see it.
Four of those mounts. We'll see it in other pictures, but it's a spectacular weapon.
Now,
and what's interesting about this one is that this was in production, but they were having trouble both training and operation. And so the vehicle had finished all of its production requirements, all of the test program, that class, and they were building them in production. But they didn't have the training for the people to operate them. That, and by the end of the war.
Now, that's a remarkable story. Did this craft come technologically from the telepathy that the 13-year-old girl began receiving, or was this one of the gifted craft to the Germans?
This is the gifted class.
Mm-hmm.
The girls' first ones, they built two of them, and those ended up actually at Area 51 here in the West Coast.
Huh.
But they were just their prototypes, and so it was just building small ones to make everything work and test
right.
it, which would be a normal thing for them to do.
Wonderful museum that would make, hey? With all those craft out there. Now, this craft, did any of these large craft with the 40-millimeter cannons, and there were two on the top as well, they may be fixed, I don't know. Did any of those go up and engage bomber formations? And if so, do you have any record of their performance? And remember, P-51s were in the air late in the war, which is probably when this was taken, and they could make about 500 miles an hour. They were real fast. So these craft could have been endangered unless they were moving extremely quickly up and down sideways, which they may have done. If they're trying to stand stationary and fire on bomber formations, I don't think that they would be too successful in all cases.
However, they were a very substantial weapon system. They did move extremely fast. And remember, essentially, the crew inside feel no gravitational. There's
right.
no gravity. And so the vehicle can make 90 degrees turns or 180s. And nobody inside feels anything. So you can have the B-51 and the pilot is he's firing his machine guns mm-hmm. at this thing, and in less than a second, it's to the side of where the machine guns are firing.
And shooting at him.
And one of the problems they had with this group of these large ones was that their crew didn't see the aircraft. But whenever they saw the aircraft coming at them, there was no problem. You could not shoot it down.
Got it. Visibility, though, you got portholes up there. You got to have people looking all the time. You also have to have a commanding officer who knows how to fly these things. And you suggested earlier that was something that was in rather short supply. They could make them, reproduce them from those that they were given, but they didn't have the crews necessary to fly them. Is that right?
Yes.
All right.
That's
now, is there any, when you were doing your debriefings at the with the spies that were coming back to North Island, did you ever see drawings or photographs of these kinds of craft flying discs?
Yes, we saw photographs, and I have seen in these, there's two group of photographs that Frank sent me, and I just got the one group today. But in this group, there's several of them which I would swear that the ones that I had seen in the top of that tower, Naval Air Station San Diego.
Wow.
I would swear that that's what it was. And so it looks exactly like it. You
mm-hmm.
see what I'm saying?
Yes, I do.
And I can't prove that, but it's so close that it could very well have been ones that we were able to see there.
What did Admiral Riccobata and what was the response? And it was just you, the Admiral, and I think one other debriefer, and then the actual operative or spy bringing material to this debriefing meeting. What did you think when you saw these wingless craft?
Well, actually, let me back off. Remember that I came in to this small group of people,
yeah.
The Riccobata's group, I came in there after I went through boot camp, okay? But that was in 1942.
Right. So they were already seeing some of these pictures.
They had already seen many of these pictures for a year or two years, and because they had been working this thing, and they were still some of the situations that were documented and presented by the operatives. The admiral did not believe, and he. Put his hand up in his head, and he said, I know all the stuff you're bringing back here and everything. He'd use profanity and say, I don't buy this at all.
So he thought there was disinformation. We were being fed this stuff to scare us.
They were being disinformation. And so then that particular effort would come up again next year, okay? Because remember, I did this for 4 years. These operatives, we had 29 of them, and they continued to go over there, get information, and come back for 4 years. And so many of the original or some of the first information, at least that I was involved in, were incorrect. But then additional information was acquired, and even I had to take the additional information over to Lockheed or over to the Naval Air Development Center, War Minister, Pennsylvania, and give them the new information, which nullified what we had already given them maybe 6 months earlier.
Got it. All right, hold on. We have to take a break. We'll come right back in just a few minutes and continue our walk through this most extraordinary and eclectic area of history of World War II.